7. The Great War and the Rise of Reza Khan, 1914-1925. On the morning of February 21, 1921, the people of Tehran woke up to the news of a military coup that in the early hours of the day had brought to power a new government. It was headed by a fiery journalist and backed by Reza Khan, a brigadier general in Iran's Cossack division. The 9-article communique posted on public thoroughfares announcing the new regime carried an unprecedented authoritarian tone. It began with the ominous phrase, "I command, Hocham Mikonam," and called upon the people of Tehran to be quiet and obedient to military commands. It warned that martial law was in effect, that all press and publications were banned, pending permits from the future government, that public gatherings were illegal, that taverns, theatres, cinemas and gambling clubs were closed, and that all government departments and communications were suspended. Whoever fails to obey the above orders, it sternly concluded, will be brought before the military tribunal and receive the harshest penalty. The proclamation was signed Reza, chief of His Majesty's Cossack Division and military commander of Tehran. Reza Khan, an ambitious 43-year-old officer, soon came to be recognized as a strong man who promised to save Iran from perpetual crisis and desperation. His meteoric rise to power and eventual establishment of the Pahlavi dynasty in 1925 was as much the outcome of the frustrations and setbacks experienced after the Constitutional Revolution as it was the outcome of a decade-long foreign occupation and imperial ambitions. He was able to rapidly consolidate because of his shrewdness and personal qualities, but also because he operated in a setting in which other options for Iran's political survival seemed to be exhausted. By 1921, the opportunity for a sovereign and functioning constitutional regime was nearly lost, leading to what Shuster had labelled a decade earlier as the strangling of Persia. It was a feat of fortune, perhaps, but also an engaging historical question as to why Iran eventually managed to escape disintegration and remain a sovereign state. At the outset of World War I, most Iranian nationalists were hopeful that Imperial Germany's challenge to the great powers would liberate Iran from Anglo-Russian hegemony. In reality, however, further misfortunes, prompted by the war, brought the Iranian government to a standstill and the country to further disarray and misery. Iran was not even a party to a war that was fought violently over Europe's imperial ambitions, pride, and power games. And if the Young Turk regime and the neighbouring Ottoman Empire was reckless to side with one power against another, the weakling Iranian government was sober enough to declare neutrality, at least on the surface. It seemed entirely unwise for Iranians to join either of the warring parties, given the high level of resentment toward Russia and Britain at home, but also the uncertain gains if Iran officially sided with the Central Powers. Despite repeated pleas to the fighting parties, Russian, British, Ottoman, and German, Iranian territory was overrun by the first three almost from the start of the war. The country's sovereignty was undermined, and its people were subjected to starvation and disease directly or indirectly resulting from the military operations. At no time since the civil wars of the 18th century had Iran faced a darker political moment than the period between 1915 and 1921. War and occupation coincided with the eclipse of nationalist hopes and the rise of secessionist movements. The rippling effects of the Bolshevik Revolution and Iran's ill-fated 1919 treaty with Britain further complicated the quagmire. Long before the outbreak of World War I, the emergence of Imperial Germany on Middle Eastern horizons impressed the Iranian nationalists, who viewed it as a dynamic but relatively benign world power. The appeal of Germany, however, went beyond its role as a diplomatic counterbalance. German nationalism as a unifying ideology, one that made possible industrial development and created an efficient state with a powerful military, was an intriguing model for Iranians as it was for the neighbouring Young Turks. Ever since the 1870s, Iranians had admired Bismarck for unifying Germany through war and diplomacy. In 1903, German success in finalizing the agreement with the Ottomans for the construction of the Istanbul-Baghdad Railway was viewed internationally as a major strategic breakthrough. It brought Germany, for the first time, close to the shores of the Persian Gulf, a body of water the British considered essential to the security of British India. Further plans to connect Tehran to the Baghdad Railway through a line across western Iran equally alarmed the Russians, who saw it an intrusion into their zone of influence. Discovery of oil in Khuzestan. The rise of Germany on the Iranian horizon coincided with the discovery of oil in Iran by a British concessionaire in the southwestern province of Khuzestan. As the site of the first oil exploration in the Middle East, the Khuzestan field proved a vital strategic resource for Britain throughout the war and after. Beyond the 1907 Anglo-Russian agreement, the discovery of oil further tied Iran's fate to the fortunes of the Great War. After the war, and throughout the 20th century and beyond, no other resource came to play as crucial a role as oil in shaping Iranian politics and economy. In 1900, a British financier, William Knox Darcy, who met the head of Iranian customs at the Paris World Exhibition, was persuaded to acquire a concession from the Qajar government for the discovery, production, and export of the vaguely identified oil fields of southern Iran. The 60-year monopoly, granted tax-free to Darcy, offered remarkable advantages to the concessionaire in exchange for only a £20,000, $100,000 advance, another £20,000 worth of stocks, and 16% of the net profit from the revenue of all the companies that were to be incorporated under the concession. In 1901, Muzaffar ad-Din Shah ratified the concession, following a successful campaign led by the British envoy in Tehran and Darcy's representative, who once worked for Julius Reuter and was recommended to Darcy by Henry Drummond Wolfe. It was as if Darcy was to compensate for the failures of the previous Reuter and Regis concessions. After several years of fruitless explorations, in May 1908, Darcy's British engineers struck a massive oil reserve in the Masjed Soleiman oil field in central Khuzestan, inside Bakhtiari territory. Soon, the construction of a 140-mile pipeline to the refinery and port facilities in the island of Abadan on the westernmost Iranian shores of the Persian Gulf made possible the overseas export of an increasing volume of oil. As early as 1909, the British Admiralty, with its eye on utilizing Darcy's concession, conceded to forming the Anglo-Persian Oil Company, APOC, as a private enterprise. In due course, the huge volume of Khuzestan oil offered an incentive to the British government to switch, following the German Navy, from coal to oil, eventually for the entire Royal Navy fleet. Despite much resistance from conservatives, by 1914 the British government had acquired the majority of APOC stocks, allowing the government full control over exploration, production, and export. In his role as the First Lord of the Admiralty, Winston Churchill was the driving force behind the purchase, an accomplishment he later hailed as one of the greatest in his long career. APOC's purchase, a rare acquisition by the British government, set Iran not against a private concessionaire, but the British Empire. The popularity of automobiles and greater reliance of all industries on oil revealed the British dependency on the Iranian resource throughout the war and beyond as an alternative to California oil, Russian-owned Baku oil, and the other oil fields explored in Burma and elsewhere. Subsequently, the security of the Khuzestan oil fields and installations became a major concern of the British, concern not only in their dealings with the Iranian central government, but also in their dealings with the Bakhtiari Khans and the Arab sheikhs of the Banu Kab Confederacy, who had a virtual control over the Iranian port of Mahamara, later Khorramshahr, and its vicinity. As early as 1907, Major Percy Cox, then the British political resident in the port of Bushehr, arranged for the arrival of a detachment of Indian sepoys to boost the security of the installations and pipelines. By 1916, this detachment had been upgraded to a full military force, called the South Persian Rifles, based in Bandar Abbas. Despite stiff resistance from the Iranian nationalists, the South Persia Rifles soon was in control of the entire British zone of influence in southern Iran. Committee for National Defence. Not long after the first shots were exchanged on the European front, and ironically, soon after Iran declared its neutrality. As early as October 1914, both the northwestern and southern Iranian provinces became battlefields for the warring parties. Devoid of an effective force to defend them, the Iranian people witnessed repeated offensives from the Russians and Ottomans along the Eastern Front, where they marched in and out of the provinces of Azerbaijan, Kermanshah, and Hamadan. Between the winter of 1914 and the spring of 1917, parts of these provinces changed hands at least 8 times between the Russian and Turkish forces, at an enormous humanitarian and economic cost to the civilian population. Both the Ottoman Turks and the Tsarist Russians committed repeated atrocities toward urban and rural inhabitants. Houses were looted, women raped, children abducted, fields burned, and their provisions confiscated. The Young Turk operations in neighboring Ottoman Anatolia forced the dislocation of 1.5 million Armenians from their ancestral homeland on a massive, genocidal scale. Tens of thousands of refugees fleeing the Ottoman army and the collaborating Kurdish irregulars crossed the border to nearby Iranian towns and villages. Tabriz and Hamadan, in particular, bore the brunt of the occupations, which caused, among other things, a typhus epidemic and widespread starvation. British advances on the Mesopotamian front between 1915 and 1917 cut off the western supply route that connected the Persian Gulf to the markets of central Iran through Basra, Baghdad, Kermanshah, and Hamadan. This further aggravated the depressed state of the Iranian economy and wreaked havoc on the price of commodities. Tehran could view this state of affairs only with a mix of horror and resignation as the warring armies moved closer to the capital. In December 1914, after a hiatus of 2 years, the third Majlis was convened. Even though the provinces were not fully represented, the very survival of the parliamentary order provided only fleeting solace to Iran's embattled nationalists. New faces represented the Democrats and Moderates. Most visible among the Moderates was Hassan Modares, approximately 1870 to 1937, a man of austere lifestyle and forthright demeanour. He was a middle-ranking cleric from Isfahan with oratorical talent and parliamentary skills. Soleiman Mirza, the Qajar nobleman who led the Democrats, would be among a handful of socialists to survive exile and assassination in the coming years. In the absence of Taghizadeh, who had fled first to Istanbul and then Berlin, he would play a significant role in the post-war era. Yet, regardless of political orientation, both factions in the Majlis soon found themselves facing domestic and international crises beyond the capacity of the feeble parliament and constant government turnover. Between 1914 and 1918, there were no fewer than 12 changes of government, nearly all headed by elite statesmen and manned by a combination of the Qajar nobility and figures who had risen to prominence during the constitutional era. Brazen intervention by the representatives of the two neighbouring powers left a limited role for the Majlis over the rise and fall of these cabinets. By 1915, the zones of influence agreed to in 1907 were no longer limited to the northern and southern provinces. There was a tacit understanding between the two powers that the entire country was fair game, so long as the accepted zones of influence were still honoured and, equally vital, Germany and the Ottoman Empire were barred from operating in the two zones at all costs. In November 1915, Russians occupied Ghazvin with the intention of marching on Tehran, and soon after an advanced detachment reached Karaj, only 30 miles west of the capital. The pretext was to preempt a pro-German coup in the capital. The upheaval brought about the closure of the third Majlis. Iranian nationalists were sympathetic toward Imperial Germany, as they were toward the Young Turks and their pan-Islamic advocacy. Before sufficiently becoming disillusioned with the Young Turks' haughty conduct or outraged by their pan-Turkist, occasionally pan-Turanist, territorial ambitions over Iranian Azerbaijan, they saw collaboration with the German-Turkish axis as a viable counter to Anglo-Russian occupation. Ottoman connections, nevertheless, were always hampering the German efforts in Iran, and Iranians never really warmed up to the idea of pan-Islamism. Backed by the energetic German envoy in Tehran and his staff, members of the Nationalist Bloc, a coalition of politicians, mostly Democrats, as well as veterans of the 1909 Civil War and a number of intellectuals and journalists, created the Committee for National Defence and began to withdraw toward Gome. They were supported by a negligible force from among the constitutionalist fighters of earlier years and some gendarme units led by Swedish officers. Facing the Russian advancing army, the committee intended to transfer the capital to Isfahan and hoped to persuade the young Ahmad Shah, who at the age of 15 has just been invested as the new Qajar monarch, to join them there. Once a mismanaged coup, organized by the German military attaché Count Karnitz, failed to move to Gome, the government of Premier Hassan Mustafi al-Mamalek, approximately 1871 to 1932, the young Shah, under pressure from the British and Russian representatives, abandoned the idea at the last hour. He was vaguely assured by the two powers that his capital would not be overrun and that he would survive on the Qajar throne. With the departure to western Iran of the so-called Muhajirin, immigrants, as the supporters of the Committee for National Defence came to be known, the capital fell even more firmly under the spell of Anglo-Russian influence and their demands for greater compliance. The breakdown of Iran's fragile resistance after brief engagements with Russian forces in the vicinity of Gome and Hamadan forced them to withdraw further west to Kermanshah and beyond toward the Ottoman border, once the Young Turks had prevailed over the British army in Kut in the summer of 1916. There, under the Turkish shield and with the backing of the German agents who were assigned to help the Iranian nationalists, the Committee for National Defence formed a provisional government in exile. There, the provisional government maintained a precarious presence until the winter of 1917, when a new Russian offensive drove the Turks, and with them most of the Muhajirin, out of Iran. With an odd mix of Majlis deputies, elderly statesmen, political activists, clerical leaders, soldiers, and intellectuals, the provisional government aimed to organize a resistance movement through a network of urban and tribal supporters. It further concluded an agreement that obligated Iran to support the Central Powers in exchange for German and Turkish efforts to wipe out the Allied presence in Iran and restore the nationalist government in Tehran. With the Russian defeat of the Ottomans in Kermanshah in April 1916, however, most of the Muhajirin were forced to retreat further to Anatolia, Kurdistan, and southern Iraq, where they awaited an uncertain future. Disillusioned and out of funds, the struggling resistance quickly fizzled. Some trickled back to Iran, and others wandered in Iraq and Syria, gravitating toward Istanbul and beyond. The provisional government was the peak of German efforts to build an anti-Allied coalition of nationalists and tribal forces in Iran. By the middle of 1915, German agents, playing on Iranian resentment toward the Allies, successfully penetrated the southern and central provinces. Through propaganda, agitation, the supply of firearms, and financial reward, or the promise of it, tireless German agents and operatives in Hamadan, Isfahan, Shiraz, Yazd, and Kerman were able to create a network that stretched from the Kurdish tribes of the Kermanshah to the Kashgais and Tangistani in Fars, and to the Banu Kab Arab tribes of southern Khuzestan. Most famous among these, Wilhelm Wasmus, a free agent of the sort operating in Fars province, who coordinated his efforts with the German Intelligence Bureau of the Orient, responsible for covert operations in the east, was able to mobilize, along with other German officers, the Kashgais of the Fars province and smaller tribes of southern Fars. They fielded a sustained insurgency against the British and their Khamseh tribal allies. Von Kardrof, taking refuge with the Bakhtiari and protected by Bibi Maryam, the influential sister of Sadr Assad, the chief of the tribe, fostered a momentary pro-German pact among the Bakhtiari. Rudolf Nadolny, the chief of the Intelligence Bureau, helped mobilize the Sanjabis and other Kurds of Kermanshah into an effective force. Oskar von Niedermayer, a senior German agent, was active in Afghanistan even though Iran proved more fertile ground for German war efforts. The German agents represented a new brand of covert operation that relied on dedication, knowledge of the terrain, military savvy, and the promise of large monetary reward. To facilitate war efforts in western Iran, The German Treasury even distributed German marks with equivalents in Persian geran printed on the banknotes. The proxy war fought in Iran relied on resources of modern German armaments that were crucial for the spread of firearms throughout the Iranian countryside. German gold, which was promised and at times spent lavishly, bought the notoriously shifting tribal loyalties only to an extent. The war operation in Iran, Afghanistan, and the Persian Gulf gave the German agents an aura of heroism that contradicted the unfulfilled financial promises made to the Khans of the collaborating tribes. A number of Iranian Germanophiles among intellectuals and poets of the period, including Mahmud Taghi Bahar, composed popular poems in support of Germany and Perso-German symbiosis. They even employed wandering dervishes to recite these poems in the mosques and bazaars of Isfahan and elsewhere. Syed Ahmad Adib Peshavari, a reclusive scholar and poet originally from Peshawar, who nursed a deep grudge against British colonialism, composed numerous panegyrics in praise of Kaiser Wilhelm II. He also composed Kesar Nameh, Book of Kaiser, an epic poem of about 5,000 verses in honour of the German Emperor, in the style of the Shahnameh. By 1918, however, hopes for a German victory over the Allies fizzled, and with it the prospects of ending the Anglo-Russian hold over Iran. Later, during the interwar period, German cultural symbiosis with Iran, underscored by archaeological excavations and philological studies of shared Aryan roots, held powerful sway over the Iranian imagination. The short-lived provisional government in exile, barely lasting until 1917, revealed all the flaws of the nationalist resistance since the days of the Constitutional Revolution. It brought to the fore factional bickering between the Democrats' leadership and their moderate rivals, the generational gap between the elder statesmen and younger firebrands, and petty rivalries and flickering loyalties. The episode also heightened romantic cries for the plight of the beloved country among such poets of national fame as Bahar, Aref, and Mirzadeh Eshki, 1893-1924. Chiefs of the Western frontier from the Sanjabi tribe of the Kermanshah region, who closely collaborated with the Muhajirin, also paid heavily for their loyalties. The ancient tactics of nomadic warfare proved inadequate in the face of European superior firepower when, in 1918, they were heavily defeated by the assault of the advancing British forces of the Mesopotamian front at the very end of the war. Resisting the South Persian Rifles. In the Fars province, the Germans allied with Gashgai Khans and further south in the Warm Country, Gamsir, with tribes of the Persian Gulf region, among them the Tangestanis north of Bushehr, and the adjacent partisans from the Dashtestan region. The chief of Tangestan, Rais Ali Delvari, who put up a stiff resistance, was killed in clashes with Indo-British forces, and his positions were pounded by British battleships. The German infiltration and prospects for a combined urban and tribal armed resistance in western and southern Iran was a legitimate pretext in the eyes of the British authorities for them to undertake, as early as 1915, similar countermeasures. The arrival of Brigadier General Percy Sykes and his British and Indian officers in March 1916, and the creation of the South Persian Rifles, SPR, secured the southern oil fields, but also countered and eventually supplanted the Iranian gendarme units in the south. First initiated by Morgan Schuster in 1911 under Swedish officers, the Iranian gendarmerie had turned into an effective arm of the state in the countryside, replacing the older Qajar rural police. By the time of the war, a number of Iranian officers in the gendarme ranks openly sympathized with the nationalist cause during the immigration and effectively fought against the Russians in Kermanshah. Their Swedish counterparts, though first supervised by British officers, also gravitated to the German side and openly sympathized with the Tangestani and Dashtestani tribal partisans, as they did in the north with the Lur and the Kurdish fighters. They served as a counterforce not only to the SPR, but also to the Russian-led Cossack division, which until 1917 had held strong ties to Imperial Russia. Relying in part on local recruits, the SPR force of up to 11,000, under a British officer corps and Indian petty officers, operated throughout the region, stretching from the Baluchistan border with British India to Kerman, Fars, Khuzestan, and Bakhtiari lands, linking in the southwest with British forces in Basra and across the Mesopotamian front. Control over the shores of the Persian Gulf and the Iranian interiors proved a formidable task even for Sykes, a diplomat, historian of Iran, and experienced colonial officer who travelled widely inside Iran and wrote about it. By the time he took over the new post, he had produced his two-volume History of Persia, the most extensive in the English language, nearly a century after John Malcolm's, and predictably from a colonial British perspective. By the end of the war, the fate of the SPR had become another complex issue in the already strained relationship between Britain and Iran. Responding to repeated objections from Tehran, the British authorities, who earlier had given their tacit agreement to hand over command of the force to Iran, made the transfer conditional on implementing the terms of the more comprehensive 1919 agreement. Specifically, the transfer was tied to the creation of a national army under British supervision. It took the coup of 1921 and the rise of Reza Khan for the British authorities to terminate the SPR in favour of a centralised state with a national army. The impact of the Bolshevik Revolution. By the middle of 1917, it seemed that the British and the Russian forces and their proxies had been able to strike heavy, perhaps fatal, blows to the fragile Iranian resistance in western, central, and southern Iran. German capabilities to offer meaningful support to any sustained insurgency also diminished. The eventual defeat of the Ottomans on the Mesopotamian front and the British capture of Baghdad in January 1917 shattered the nationalists' hopes for recovery on the western Iranian front. To many, it appeared as if their country would never recover from the bouts of political chaos and foreign intervention. Yet the Bolshevik Revolution of October 1917 rekindled Iranian aspirations at a time when Germany and its Turkish ally were rapidly losing their strategic gains, and with it, their credibility. With the exception of the Great War itself, perhaps no other international event left as lasting an effect on Iran's early 20th century history. The collapse of Tsarist Russia, then in control of nearly two-thirds of Iranian territory, both terrified and exhilarated Iran. Fear of the Bolshevik regime and its communist ideology heightened among the elite as the Red Army moved closer to the Caucasus and the Iranian border. On the one hand, as became apparent in early 1918, the collapse of Imperial Russia promised an end not only to Russian occupation, but also to more than a century of its hegemonic ambition. That Iran could escape what had appeared to be almost certain disintegration, the North annexed by Russia and the South by Britain, could hardly be considered anything less than a miracle. As early as December 1917, the vulnerable Bolshevik regime, searching for regional allies, denounced the 1907 Anglo-Russian agreement as a ploy of Western imperialism and called on the world to allow Iran to decide its own destiny. By June 1919, Moscow not only rescinded all of Iran's loan commitments due to Russia, but also repealed all the public and private concessions acquired by the Tsarist regime as early as the capitulatory privileges of the 1828 Treaty of Turkmenchai. Moreover, it handed over to Iran most of the Russian port facilities on the Persian side of the Caspian and the sector of the Julfar Railroad on Iranian soil, and it gave Iran control of the Russian mortgage bank. Nullification of these concessions was finalised in the 1921 Soviet-Iranian Treaty of Friendship, which was skillfully negotiated by Iranian diplomats in the face of British obstruction. Despite these friendly gestures, the appeal of communist ideology to many Iranian nationalists was by no means imminent. Many Democrats who entertained a homegrown socialist ideology admired the Bolshevik Revolution and the new Soviet model, but not slavishly. Democrats in Shiraz, for instance, well-equipped and in good morale, welcomed the Russian Revolution as a life-saving breakthrough that could unravel the SPR's hold over the South. The conservative statesmen in Tehran were mostly accustomed to the Anglo-Russian rivalry, or worse, subservient to Britain and its hostility to the Bolsheviks. Nevertheless, by 1918, The Premier, Samsam al-Sultaneh, took advantage of the new regime's friendly gestures and, much to the anger of the British, unilaterally denounced the 1907 agreement and cancelled all privileges for any foreign powers in Iran. The instability of successive short-lived governments in Tehran, however, did not allow for more serious engagement with the Bolsheviks. Yet, despite the cool reception at the capital, soon the majority of the Iranian polity began to feel the Soviet ideological and military presence. As early as the end of 1919, Bolshevik partisans landed in the Caspian port of Anzali, with the apparent intent to recapture the Russian fleet and dislodge the loyalist detachments of the Russian counter-revolutionary White Army from northern Iran. They advanced as far south as the vicinity of Ghazvin before being pushed back by Iranian regular forces and units of the Cossack Brigade. This happened at a critical juncture when the newly created North Persian Force, NORPA Force, under British command, had come to the rescue of the White Army. Earlier, in late 1917, immediately after the Russian withdrawal from World War I, the British NORPA Force had consolidated its gains in northern Iran by occupying Hamadan, Kermanshah, and Ghazvin, and had moved toward the Caspian shores, where it joined forces with the White Russian detachments. The default occupation of northern Iran, as far as northern Khorasan, which was outside the traditional scope of British interest, was a remarkable gain, but also a huge liability. As it turned out, the British move had important consequences for Iran's political future. By the spring of 1920, the Soviet Red Army replaced bands of Caucasian Bolshevik partisans in an operation aimed not only to remove the remnants of the White Russian detachments and the local Caucasian nationalists in Baku and Tiflis, but also to aid the Iranian nationalist Janghel movement in Gilan. The chief aim of Russian revolutionaries, such as the war commissar Leon Trotsky, in landing troops in Iran, was to frighten the British and hamper their support for the White Army. They held a view that Iran was not ripe for a Bolshevik-style revolution, while others, mostly communists from the Caucasus, firmly believed in exporting revolution by covert or overt assistance to the indigenous nationalist movements. As in neighbouring Republic of Turkey, the lure of Bolshevism grew stronger among Iranian nationalists once the Great War came to an end and the Iranian political landscape appeared ever more bleak. In 1918, hope for the Paris Peace Conference and President Woodrow Wilson's doctrine of self-determination to address Iran's grievances soon evaporated. This was at a time when British forces occupied nearly the entire country and the Janghel movement was divided and distraught. It was as if Iran had gotten a worse deal than it had when Tsarist Russia had occupied much of the country. Nationalists were further disillusioned and disarmed as the weakling central government struggled to remain relevant. On the more positive side, the Bolshevik invasion of the north provided a justification for Iran to be accepted into the League of Nations. Soon after, by March 1920, to counter growing British influence, the Iranian government reached out to Moscow in the hope of stabilizing the situation in the north. The Anglo-Persian Agreement. The Anglo-Persian Agreement of 1919 was a clear indication of how Iran was about to be shepherded into a semi-protectorate status. This was in contrast to the buffer status that had defined its geopolitics for more than a century. The controversial agreement was the brainchild of two men and their evolving visions for the British imperial presence in the region. George Curzon, then the British acting foreign secretary and a long-time observer of Iranian affairs, and Percy Cox, then the British envoy in Tehran, and, as it turned out, one of the most influential players in the shaping of the Arab Middle East. Earlier in his career, Curzon visited Iran in 1891 as the Times of London's special correspondent and produced the voluminous Persia and the Persian Question, an overview of everything Iranian with unmistakably imperial overtones. He viewed Iran's material development under the benevolent aegis of the British as key for securing long-term British interests. Cox, educated in colonial India, shared with his superior the view that the agreement would grant Iran an undeclared British protectorate status under the guise of financial and military cooperation. On the surface, The 1919 agreement indeed promised, in benign terms, collaboration between the two sovereign states. Britain consented to provide Iran with financial, technical, and military assistance in exchange for Iran's exclusive reliance on Britain for such matters as defence and foreign advisers. The preamble to the agreement reaffirmed the ties of friendship between the two countries and promoted progress and prosperity of Persia, while Article 1 reiterated, in the most categorical manner, the independence and integrity of Persia. Other articles stipulated the appointment of British financial and military advisers at Iran's expense, promised a long-term British loan to finance military and economic development, for which government revenues and customs were sought as security. The agreement also recognized the need for growth in trade and for development projects such as the railway. A supplementary loan agreement set the amount of the loan at £2 million, $9,580,000, with 7% interest, and subordinated it to the servicing of an earlier loan due to be paid to Britain. Yet below the veneer of diplomatic platitude lurked an agenda. The British motives for entering into the 1919 agreement sprang primarily from Curzon's desire to create a chain of mandatory states and protectorates to guarantee a secure overland connection throughout the empire. He had long argued that only through active engagement in the Iranian economy and with the control of its government apparatus and reconstruction of its army could Britain expect a secure and stable Iran. The arrangement served not only as a bulwark against the threat of Bolshevism, but also as a sure way to include Iran, a vital but weak link, in a Pax Britannica that stretched from India and the Persian Gulf to Iraq, Palestine, and Egypt. The grand strategy that Curzon prescribed appealed to like-minded politicians such as Winston Churchill, who in 1919, as Secretary of State for War, underscored the importance of the security of the Iranian oil fields to British post-war supremacy. From the perspective of Iranian statesmen, most notably the Premier Hassan Vosagh Galdoleh, 1868-1951, and chief members of his cabinet, the agreement carried the promise of saving Iran from domestic disarray and Bolshevik threat. The agreement, moreover, provided the state with much-needed funds and technical expertise. By the second decade of the 20th century, it appeared to Iranian statesmen, such as Vosagh Galdoleh, that with the collapse of Imperial Russia, Iran's role as a buffer state had come to an end, and that its sovereignty and territorial integrity could be guaranteed only through the backing of British Empire, the winner of the war and the new master of the Middle East. In an exchange of letters between Cox and Vosagh Galdoleh, Britain reassured Iran of its support for war reparations in the Paris Peace Conference and favourable renegotiation of all Anglo-Persian treaties. Yet, behind the seemingly benign terms of the agreement, most Iranians detected the ghost of British hegemony. If any proof was needed, it was furnished, after the collapse of Vosagh Galdoleh's government in June 1920, in large monetary gifts paid by Cox to the Premier and two of his chief ministers to lubricate the ratification of the agreement. The rumour-ridden political circles of Tehran opposed the agreement, and the nationalist press, with few exceptions, portrayed it as compromising Iran's sovereignty. In this regard, the efforts of Vosagh Galdoleh to present the agreement as the best Iran could afford under the circumstances did not succeed. A capable and cultured statesman of great erudition, who once served as the Speaker of the First Majlis, Vosagh hoped to leverage the agreement to bring political stability and economic reform. Vosagh Galdoleh and his energetic foreign minister Firuz Mirza Nosrat Galdoleh were unfairly labelled in nationalist circles as traitors to the Iranian cause. Almost unanimous opposition to the agreement, which had yet to be ratified by the then-suspended Majlis, expressed by the burgeoning, though often naively sentimental, press. After a decade of national struggle, compliance with the spirit of the 1919 agreement discredited the Qajar nobility and its associated bureaucratic elite in the eyes of the urban intelligentsia. Iranian public opinion was further buoyed by international condemnation of the British desire to unceremoniously devour Iran as yet another client state. The Woodrow Wilson administration, in particular, was incensed by the disingenuous methods the British employed in the Paris Peace Conference to keep Iran from presenting its grievances, even though it is quite possible that earlier the United States had condoned the agreement. In contrast to the Egyptian Wafd Party, whose presence at the conference highlighted the Egyptian nationalist struggle for independence, the Iranian delegation was barred from even bringing to the table its demands for mere recognition, let alone compensation, of the foreign occupation and economic and human losses that Iran had sustained during the war. The British delegation, overruling the Americans, argued that the Iranian case could not be heard in the conference since Iran was not a party to the war and thus did not have a place in the post-war settlement. Informally, Curzon assured the American and French delegations that Britain respected Iran's sovereignty and would help rectify its grievances. With the prospects of Britain as the mandatory power in Palestine and Iraq, the implementation of both to be presided over by Percy Cox, such assurances about Iran appeared highly suspicious. The 1919 agreement was thus seen by the Wilson administration as a backdoor method to greater British colonial expansion. The French had their own axe to grind. They were evidently unhappy with the 1919 agreement because the implementation of the 1916 Sykes-Picot agreement had left Palestine out of the French-Syrian mandate and under British control. Domestic and international uproar cast a shadow over the ratification of the Anglo-Persian agreement, although this did not stop its advocates from trying to implement some of its terms. The Vosagel-Dolé government began employing British civilian and military advisers, who practically were to run government ministries, reform the country's finances, and try to realize the long-standing aspirations for a uniform Iranian army. With British financial backing, essentially resuming the monetary payments negotiated during the war, the Iranian government managed to score a few successes, primarily in quelling unrest in the provinces. The persistent Janghel rebellion sustained heavy blows from the joint operations of the Iranian Regular Army and the Iranian Cossack and Gendarme regiments. Since the end of the war, they had both enjoyed the logistical backing of British forces. In Kashan, too, the highly disruptive Naeb Hossein, a bandit whose raids terrorized the entire region, was captured and hanged. Most of his men were disbanded as well. Yet the possibility of Bolshevik advances toward Tehran, however remote, never dissipated. Nor were the Iranian nationalists or the young Ahmad Shah ever convinced of British sincerity. In a rare display of courage in his otherwise unhappy career as the last Qajar monarch, Ahmad Shah showed evident signs of dismay over the conclusion of the agreement during his official visit to Britain in September 1919. It is likely, however, that his hesitation was motivated by his exclusion from receiving a share of the British commission for the conclusion of the agreement surreptitiously paid to his ministers. Having lost backing from Britain in June 1920, the Vosagel-Dolé government was dismissed by the Shah. With domestic and international pressure, the chances of the agreement ever being ratified by the prospective Fourth Majlis had faded. By early 1920, it became evident even to Curzon and his critics in the British Parliament that the Anglo-Persian agreement was essentially dead. In Iran, no one celebrated the demise of the agreement, not even the vociferous nationalist press. Most people recognized that as long as Britain maintained a military presence, held sway over the political elite, and controlled the southern oil fields, it was unlikely to give up its interests in Iran. Mirza Qaçak Khan and the Janghel movement. If one individual can characterize all the hopes and despair of non-elite Iranians of the post-war period, that individual most likely is Mirza Qaçak Khan, 1880-1921. Likewise, if one movement epitomizes the tragic ideological drifting and factional conflicts of post-constitutional Iran, that movement is the Janghel movement. Together, Qaçak Khan and his Janghel resistance would become part of the martyr narrative that permeates Iran's mythical memory and marks its historical landscape. Born to a family of petty landowners in the provincial capital of Rasht, Qaçak Khan was a student in the local seminary when he first heard and was moved by the message of the constitutional revolution. following flocks of Iranians to the oil-rich city of Baku and later to the Georgian capital of Tiflis, he was exposed to the revolutionary trends among the Azerbaijanis and Armenians in the Caucasus, and to the émigré merchants, home-brewed revolutionaries and drifters. On his return to Iran, he joined the Gilan constitutionalists during the civil war of 1908 to 1909, but in Tehran the euphoria of the 1909 victory quickly gave way to disillusionment as Qaçak Khan witnessed the return to power of the old elites, joined by wealthy provincial landowners. By the time he volunteered in July 1911 to fight against the deposed Muhammad Ali Shah in the Battle of Gomish Tepe, north of Astarabad, where he was wounded and captured by Russians, he seemed to have lost hope in the success of the parliamentary process. Upon his release from detention, distraught and penniless, he returned to Rasht, where his anti-Russian activities forced him into hiding from the Russian occupying force. A devout and austere Muslim, at the outset of the Great War, he seems to have been sufficiently enamoured of the message of pan-Islamism, which at the time was heavily promoted by the Young Turks regime, to contact the Ottoman and German legations in Tehran. He entertained the idea of organizing a partisan war in the thick forests of his homeland in the province of Gilan. With little logistical support and even less local backing, Qaçak and a handful of like-minded local supporters managed to mobilize a small guerrilla force. By 1914, they had consolidated in and around the village of Pasikhan near Rasht, the birthplace of the 14th-century founder of the Noktavi movement. Soon after, he was joined by local peasants, artisans, shopkeepers, and petty landowners, but also by journalists, intellectuals, and former revolutionaries. Handsome, charismatic, and witty, yet also easily irritable and fatalistic, the 33-year-old Qaçak Khan founded what is perhaps the 20th century's first guerrilla movement, with its revolutionary ideology and a semblance of partisan organization. He may also be considered a crucial link between romantic nationalism with a socialist flavor and new interpretations of Islam as an anti-imperialist force. He was dressed in an iconic local outfit of the Galesh peasant of Gilan, a round felt cap, coarse leather shoes, and the thick sleeveless felt jacket worn by the shepherds of the Fuman region. With wild, uncut hair and a massive black beard, the sight of Qaçak and the Janghyali fighters was utterly and deliberately divorced from the urbane world from which most of their leaders had come. Posing proudly for cameras, often with their rifles held diagonally across their chest and with bulky rounds of ammunition strapped to their torso, they embodied patriotism and a love affair with firearms. Towering high over his disciples, Qaçak Khan loomed as a prophet in the wilderness, defying occupation and corrupt authorities, and seeking to make right all the wrongs his nation had sustained. That he chose a forest, Jangal, to launch a partisan war may in part be because of his familiarity with his native terrain, but also because of the symbolism that the forest invoked as the birthplace of a salvation movement. Before 1917, the small band of Jangalese was little more than a nuisance to the Russian occupiers and the provincial authorities who collaborated with them. They occasionally ambushed Russian troops, looted their arsenals, and extorted revolutionary levies from local landowners and merchants under the pretext of protecting peasants against their oppressive landlords. In collaboration with the Committee for Islamic Unity in Rasht, itself motivated by the Young Turks' pan-Islamist propaganda, Qaçak Khan organized a Jangal committee of local dignitaries from the towns and villages of Gilan to expand his grassroots network beyond his base in the forests of Fuman. He even published a newspaper, Jangal, as an organ of the movement, and issued a stamp. Government and military attempts to defeat the Jangalese failed, even with Russian help. Repeated emissaries sent to negotiate a peaceful surrender bore little result. Nor, though, did the Jangalese achieve a breakthrough in its first objective to control Gilan, and therefrom to launch a liberation movement and capture the capital. Several skirmishes with the Iranian and Russian detachments resulted in casualties on both sides, but there was no strategic or popular victory on either side. In mid-1917, it seemed as though the Jangal movement had been contained to the level of a native rebellion. It had lost much of its steam and stood little chance of ever coming out of the woods. The Bolshevik Revolution and the subsequent withdrawal of Russian troops from Gilan, however, helped transform the Jangiel movement. The October Revolution, as it turned out, also hastened the collapse of the Jangiel resistance. By 1918, the demise of the Young Turks had resulted in the loss of logistical support for the Jangielese. The withdrawal of Turkish officers, who provided military support to the movement, also prompted an ideological shift. Kerchak Khan and his followers de-emphasized pan-Islamism and instead highlighted revolutionary socialism. They nonetheless strived to remain loyal to their anti-imperialist ideals while preserving their Islamic identity. With Bolshevism in the air so close to the Jangiel base, a greater tilt toward socialism in the movement seemed unavoidable. British military advances toward Gilan, as well as government troops and the prospect of implementing the 1919 agreement, served as other incentives. With the collapse of the White Russian resistance under General Anton Denikin along the Caspian coast, the Russian fleet that had taken shelter in the port of Anzali fell to the Bolsheviks. Declaring their support for the Jangielese, the Bolsheviks and their supporters from the Caucasus soon took the initiative away from Kerchak Khan. Backed by the Red Army, they aimed to use the Jangiel movement as a springboard to incite a socialist revolution on the Russian model. Most important among the newcomers from the Socialist Adalat Party of Baku was Eskhanullah Khan, an Iranian French-educated native of Azerbaijan who came from a Baha'i background. He was previously an active member of a revolutionary cell in Tehran known as Komitei Mojazat, the Punishment Committee, that plotted the assassination of a number of government employees and conservative clergy. As much as Kerchak was a nationalist with Islamic sentiments, Eskhanullah and his band were unabashed secularists with a Marxist program. Relying on Bolshevik support in June 1920, Eskhanullah and his supporters declared the short-lived Soviet Socialist Republic of Iran, better known as Gilan Socialist Republic, with Eskhanullah himself the first president. Kerchak Khan was left with no choice but to give his consent. He was bestowed with the largely ceremonious title of President of the Council of People's Commissars. Backed by a Bolshevik commissar and an assortment of Russian partisans and other revolutionaries anxious to establish a socialist regime in Iran, the Jangielese managed to capture Rasht in June 1920. They not only defeated the local gendarme detachment, but pushed back British troops to Manjil, 45 miles south of Rasht, on the way to Tehran. The assault inflicted great damage on the mercantile community of the city, destroyed the bazaar, and resulted in the Bolsheviks' looting of merchandise. The affluent merchants and landowners were terrorized and their properties confiscated. Although Kerchak Khan left Rasht in protest, the socialist wing of the Jangiel movement hailed the capture of the provincial capital as a great victory and the first step toward installing of a Soviet-style republic. Labelled by Tehran as intruders, Motejaserin, the Bolsheviks and their Jangieli allies were declared a national threat, especially after having quashed the Iranian Cossack regiment that Tehran had dispatched from Ghazvin to counter their advances. Among the Cossack officers taking part in the operation was Reza Khan, who would later remind his officers and troops of the humiliating defeat as the lowest point of his military career, and single it out as a motive for the February 1921 coup. Moreover, the poorly equipped and starving Cossack regiment was not helped by friendly fire from the British Royal Air Force, which mistakenly bombed the central government's positions in the thick of the Caspian Forest. These advances put the Jangiel movement on Iran's political map as a revolutionary counterpoint to the weakling Tehran establishment and the doomed 1919 agreement. The chances of the Jangiel Bolshevik forces breaking through British defence lines in Ghazvin and marching on Tehran caused great anxiety. Surprisingly, despite visible signs of a rift, the Tehran government proved incapable of exploiting the ideological divisions within the Jangiel movement. In July, subject to an internal coup, the marginalised Kerchak Khan found himself at an unwelcome impasse. Retreating to the forest, he was unable to stop the movement's bent toward revolutionary socialism or enter into a reliable alliance with the rejuvenated Democrats in Tehran. Starvation pandemics, and a ruined economy. The bleakness of the Iranian situation went beyond occupation, political disarray, banditry, troop movements, skirmishes, and domestic strife. Even more, human and material losses came to haunt the people of Iran. By the close of the Great War, a famine ravaged Iran, claiming a vast number of lives. It was primarily a result of successive droughts, which in turn caused repeated crop failures and disruptions to the agricultural cycle. Excessive production of cash crops at the expense of foodstuffs also contributed to shortages, and a lack of efficient road and communication networks barred the transport of relief to remote towns and villages. Not since 1869 to 1871 had Iran experienced such widespread starvation, and in some instances towns and villages in the central provinces experienced massive depopulation. Along with Armenia, Greater Syria, and Greece, the Iranian plight drew Western public attention, especially in the United States, and encouraged charity collections and an organized relief operation. The casualties from the famine were further exacerbated by an outbreak of cholera endemic to the region, and the more deadly Spanish influenza pandemic of 1918 to 1919, whose virulent worldwide spread was facilitated by troop movements. Unlike in Europe and the United States, where the spread of influenza was partially checked by preventive measures, in Iran there was next to no prevention or even recognition of the disease known as European common cold, Zokame Farangi. The casualties from influenza are difficult to assess, but a conservative estimate of loss of life in Iran due to famine and disease exceeded 1 million. This was an enormous loss for a country with a total population of no more than 9 million, that did not field a single soldier in the war, and was not allowed to bring its grievances to the table after the war. Foreign occupation no doubt also intensified the Iranian famine. Large consignments of grain and foodstuffs were both purchased and confiscated by Russian and British armies for consumption by their troops. The starving population in the countryside had no choice but to move to towns and cities in search of food. The growing population in urban centres not only overwhelmed the minuscule relief operations, but also increased the spread of disease. Some popular historians claim that the famine was a result of deliberate and sinister starvation policies of the British, but such claims are not substantiated. For those Iranians who survived, the future was no more promising. Worldwide inflation at the end of the war sharply raised the prices of imports, and the export of traditional commodities declined. War increased Iran's dependency on European markets at a time when the economy of its major partner, Russia, had come to a complete standstill because of the revolution there. The German economy was in recession, and Ottoman markets were depressed because of the defeat in the Great War and the ensuing civil war. Britain remained the only viable partner, and trade thrived along the newly revived Basra-Kermanshah-Hamadan route. Yet even the British economy was in the grips of hyperinflation, with a labour revolt both at home and in British India. As a result, Iranian export commodities, such as wool, carpets, cotton, tobacco, and opium, became less marketable. The Iranian countryside was more volatile than it had been since perhaps the 18th century, largely because of the volume of firearms dispersed by German and British agents during the war among the Kashgai, the Bakhtiari, the Lurs, the Kurds, and the tribes of the southern Fars, all looted after 1917 from Russian armories. The effects of gun running and increased tribal unrest were twofold. They reduced the economic productivity of nomadic regions and made the trade routes through those regions insecure. Aside from tribal rebellions, by the close of the Great War, there were at least 15 groups of bandits wreaking havoc in smaller cities and ravaging the countryside. No doubt the war economy did create its own profiteers, smugglers, and suppliers of provisions to the occupying armies. This class of traders and merchants gradually came to compete with, though not supplant, established merchants in large cities. Throughout the 1910s, political unrest and economic downturn weakened the enterprising spirit of the mercantile bourgeoisie that had emerged from the Constitutional Revolution. enthusiasm sapped for new industrial initiatives such as cotton mills, textile factories, sugar refineries, and banking establishments. By the end of the war, the merchant class that a decade earlier had acted as the engine behind the revolution in Tabriz, Baku, Isfahan, Kerman, and Tehran had run out of steam. Even in the province of Gilan, where the merchants of Rasht and Anzali first collaborated with Kochak Khan in hopes of maintaining a semblance of stability, soon came to be terrorized by the excesses of Jangel radicals. The pro-Bolshevik faction of the Jangel movement adopted a hostile attitude toward large landowners and merchants of the province. Their Russian Bolshevik counterparts had already ruined the affluent merchant community of Baku across the Caspian, a community once supportive of the Iranian constitutionalists. On a broader scale, starvation and abject poverty became familiar features of the Iranian landscape. Memoirs, reports, and photographs from the end of the war reveal multitudes of beggars in rags, malnourished children clinging to their parents searching for food, day laborers with sunken eyes weakly searching through the rubble, and crowds of angry women gathering in front of government offices to protest food shortages, the deteriorating quality of bread, and swindlers. The sight of strangers dying of hunger or disease on street corners was not uncommon. Even more common was starving people hunting stray dogs and cats and rats in basements and waterholes. Rumors of young children being snatched and eaten circulated with the same rapidity of reports of the Bolsheviks breaching Tehran's walls. For the Iranians, it was as if the entire world around them were crumbling. Looking beyond their borders, they saw how the neighboring Ottoman Empire, in its death throes, had birthed competing nationalist entities. That Arab nationalist regimes were first nursed by European powers and then exploited by them under the guise of the mandate regimes, so as to advance the British and the French colonial ambitions, was a fact not entirely missed by the Iranian intelligentsia. The Russian Empire was no more, and there was no Imperial Germany to counter the unnerving pressures of the British Empire. Britain appeared to be the victorious party throughout Palestine, Mesopotamia, and the Persian Gulf, and even in the newly emerging Wahhabi-dominated Central Arabia. For Iranians with historical ties to the Shi'i lands of southern Mesopotamia, the 1920s Shi'i revolt against British occupation aroused much sympathy, if for no other reason than the fact that the revolt included in its leadership several activist Iranian ulama. By October 1920, the British crushed the revolt, a disheartening message, especially for a sector of the Iranian population in contact with the large community of Mojaverin, those who took residence in the Shi'i shrine cities of Iraq, or followed the Marjaz in Najaf. Shortly after the creation of Mandatory Iraq, assigned to Britain by the League of Nations in 1921, was an even more striking development. The Mandate almost instantaneously patched together a new country from three heterogeneous and ethnically and religiously diverse provinces of the defunct Ottoman Empire. The emergence of the Republic of Turkey from the ruins of the Young Turks' military adventures, in contrast, was a success story for neighboring countries. The carving up of the Ottoman lands, nevertheless, generated more despair and resentment than optimism in the Iranian press. The rise of Colonel Reza Khan. On the surface, it seemed that sheer luck had saved Iran from being broken up or otherwise subordinated to a British regional scheme. Yet a complex set of political and cultural factors made possible the coup of February 1921 and the subsequent rise of Reza Khan. There were as many rumors about an imminent takeover of the capital and partition of Iran into a Bolshevik North and a British South, as there were yearnings in nationalist circles for the rise of a leader who could offer a viable alternative to the bleak state of affairs. The coup of 1921 would prove this point, though with a curious twist. The process that brought to power Syed Ziauddin Tabatabai, with Reza Khan as the military leader of the new regime, was an alternative to the 1919 Anglo-Persian Agreement, a backdoor solution to the troubling political impasse that Iran faced at that time. The solution was brewed at least in part by British diplomats and senior army officers, and manned by ambitious Iranian upstarts. the astute British minister in Tehran, Herman Norman, sensed the futility in adhering to the disempowered Qajar elite, while in the wake of post-war demobilization there was an urgent call to evacuate the British troops stationed in Iran. With socialist aspirations on the rise, Democrats returning to the Tehran political stage, and the threat of the Gilan Socialist Republic on the horizon, it stood to reason that the British minister search for an alternative ally. An Anglophile, distant from the Qajar elite, who could resonate with larger sectors of the Iranian public, and at the same time appear sufficiently distant from the British. Syed Ziauddin Tabatai, 1888-1969, a young, fiery political activist known for his pro-British sentiments, was about the only Iranian journalist who consistently advocated the ratification of the 1919 agreement and its benefits for Iran in his newspaper Ra'ad, Thunder. Contrary to the maligned image of him as a British proxy in later Iranian historiography, Syed Zia may well have proposed the idea of the coup to the British legation in Tehran rather than being a mere catalyst for the coup. A madrasa novice turned journalist with a dramatic style and sensational rhetoric, Syed Zia was a product of the post-constitutional era. Though still in clerical garb, he epitomized a new breed of political activists at a time when religious training was no longer valued and the dent in clerical prestige was substantial. Known for his sensational attacks on the old Tehran political guard, he allegedly used his newspaper as an extortion tool. Initially mentored by the Premier Vasuq al-Dowleh to counter criticism of the 1919 agreement and raise the alarm of the threat of Bolshevism, he was dispatched in 1919 to Baku to sign a friendship treaty with the anti-Bolshevik nationalist regime in the elusive hopes of forging a new confederation between Iran and Azerbaijan. The mission was aborted over disagreement with the Premier on the terms of the treaty. After the collapse of Vasuq's government, Syed Zia remained in contact with the British legation. With the change in the political climate and the surge in anti-elite propaganda in the Persian press, Syed Zia became a more viable choice to head the semi-clandestine Iron Committee, a quasi-revolutionary party financed by the British legation to foster popular anti-Bolshevik sentiments. In December 1920, the political impasse reached a point of crisis. After the resignation of Mushir ad-Dowleh, 1872-1935, a respected statesman with a far-reaching program of reform who headed a short-lived coalition, no one among the Tehran statesmen seemed to be capable of forming a government or even volunteering to undertake such a task. Fat Ali Khan Sepahdar Rashti, 1878-1947, a large landowner from Gilan with no political talent to speak of, also gave up after twice tinkering with creating a cabinet. The fourth majlis, which was elected in the long shadow of the 1919 agreement, was incapable of even convening its inaugural session, lest it face the prospect of ratifying the hated agreement. The Bolshevik Jangeli threat loomed large in Gilan and in the provinces of Azerbaijan and Khorasan. New revolts were in gestation. The south was almost in the hands of the Gashgais, and most of the other tribal powers of Greater Fars, Isfahan and Luristan were restive. The constitutional monarch, Ahmad Shah, was a timid procrastinator who regarded his constitutionality as one of cynical non-action. He was genuinely frightened by the prospect of British military withdrawal from Iran and baffled by the consequences of such an event for the survival of his throne. Major figures of the constitutional era, on the other hand, were invariably disillusioned and divided. Some lost credibility or went into exile. Others were retired from politics or killed in action. The most distinguished among the exiles, Hassan Taghizadeh, the ranking member of the first majlis, had resided in Berlin since 1915. He was invited there by the German government to organize a resistance circle of Iranian nationalists, intellectuals, and activists to be dispatched back to Iran as agents provocateurs. Taking advantage of the occasion, together with a group of talented writers and intellectuals, he founded the influential periodical Kaveh. By 1920, the Berlin Circle was nearly at its end, But Taghizadeh was still uncertain of a political prospect in Tehran. Closely identified with the vanquished party in the war, he lingered there. It was in such a climate that the British envoy Norman endorsed Sayed Zia's plan to stage a coup and subsequently form a national government. He did so perhaps without the Foreign Office's prior knowledge and full support. By the last months of 1920, more than 2 years after World War I ended, the British forces stationed in northern Iran were ready to leave. With mandatory commitments in Iraq and Palestine straining British finances, the budget for the upkeep of British forces faced serious opposition in the House of Commons. These considerations made any plan for a successful coup dependent on a viable military partner that could stand as a substitute for the departing British forces. The search for such an alternative had preoccupied for some time the British command in Ghazvin, the headquarters of the Norpa force. Major General Edmund Ironside, 1880-1959, the commander of the Norpa force, his second-in-command, Lieutenant Colonel Henry Smith, and a few other middle-ranking officers, were saddled with the task of reorganizing the Cossack Brigade, which they ultimately hoped to incorporate into a uniform Iranian army, an objective of the 1919 agreement. After 1917, the Cossack Brigade, deprived of moral and material support from Imperial Russia, found itself under-budgeted, poorly equipped, demoralized, and devoid of a strong command. It was a shadow of what it had been only a few years earlier. Defeated by the Jangyal forces and their Bolshevik allies in Gilan, it became clear that Russian senior officers, even if unsympathetic to the Bolsheviks, could no longer reliably command the entirely Iranian rank and file, given the Russian officers' deep hostility toward the British and their Iranian supporters. Ironside was anxious to find a capable Iranian senior officer with combat experience and anti-Bolshevik credentials to lead the force. Colonel Reza Khan, recommended by another Iranian senior Cossack officer, seemed to be the desirable person to match such a job description. Tall, dark, broad-shouldered and charismatic, with piercing eyes, Reza Khan's rugged military demeanor and management skills, as it turned out, were ideal for the task. As a Cossack officer, he had demonstrated leadership and savvy, but also severity and ruthlessness, qualities that had allowed him to rise through the Cossack ranks from his humble beginnings as a stable boy at the age of 15 to senior officer in the Hamadan Cossack Regiment at the age of 43. Born around 1877 to a soldiering family from the Palani clan in the remote village of Arlasht, in the mountainous Savadku district of the Caspian province of Mozandaran, Reza Khan's father and grandfather had served in the Qajar army. His mother was the daughter of a Muslim emigre, Mohajer, from Iravan, who had settled in Tehran after the population exchange at the conclusion of the Russo-Persian War of 1826 to 1828. Reza's father died while he was still an infant, so his destitute mother took her son to Tehran, where she lived with her brothers, one of them a soldier in the newly established Cossack division. Reza had lost his mother at the age of 6, and his childhood and early youth were filled with forlorn neglect and virtually no education. The first available record of Reza Khan's service dates to 1911, when as a petty officer he fought in the northwest against the counter-revolutionary prince Salara Dole. By 1918, when the Cossack Brigade, now renamed Cossack Division, repelled the Naebi rebellion in Kashan, Reza was promoted to the rank of colonel. Involved in the inner politics of the Cossack Division, he took an active part in the removal of a commanding Russian officer because of his alleged Bolshevik proclivities. As he sensed an opportunity for power, he further gravitated toward the British officers in their headquarters at Ghazvin. With the changing political climate, which put the British officers in control of all resources, promotions, and the very existence of the Cossack Division, it is difficult to imagine how a shrewd and ambitious officer like Reza Khan could have done otherwise. It is also hard to believe that Reza Khan's involvement in the coup in the making could have been organized without at least tacit British knowledge. Without subscribing to the wild speculations common at the time, or the later hypotheses that the British hatched the coup, reliable evidence points to some British effort to facilitate collaboration between the civilian wing of the coup and its military counterpart. The Cossack force of about 4,000 under Reza Khan's command was partially re-equipped and financed in Ghazvin by officers of the Norpa force. They may even have encouraged Reza Khan to march on the capital to block perceived Bolshevik advances. However, it was only in the vicinity of Tehran that Reza Khan came to know Seyed Zia. Even at this stage, the latter did not have a clear idea of the practicalities and logistics of the coup. Yet, if Colonel Reza Khan had collaborated with British officers, or was even handpicked by them, he was by no means their puppet, or even willing to succumb to their wishes.